Welcome to the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation for Wednesday, April 8th. And we have a number of bills on our agenda. And I'll start by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 849. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 849 establishes a statewide audio newspaper service within the Public Utilities Commission for persons who are blind or print disabled. It funds the program through existing retail telephone subscriber monthly surcharge. It extends the sunset of the telephone surcharge and its funded programs at an additional 10 years to January 1st, 2020. It also declares emergency effective upon passage.
Okay, so to get the proper background on this before we get the public testimony, I'm going to ask Aaron Fair from Senator Bates' office, who's the sponsor of the bill, also Brant Wolf from Oregon Telecom, and Lee Beyer, chairman of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. If these three would all come forward together that are signed up, then we'll get a good grip of what this issue is, and then we'll have people comment on it once they've had the expertise that has been provided by you three. But we'll start with the proponent from Senator Bates' office.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Aaron Fair, and I am Senator Bates' policy advisor, legislative assistant. And we agreed to bring this bill forward. A constituent of ours brought it to us. And the primary goal of this bill is to provide a stable funding source for the NFB Newsline, which is a newspaper service that is accessible to the blind. It's available both on the telephone as well as over the internet. It's currently funded by, and the advocates can tell you a little bit more about the details of its funding stream, but it's currently funded by the National Federation for the Blind, the Oregon chapter of that, as well as the state library, and I believe there's one other source that I can't remember off the top of my head. But anyway, there's some concern about the stability of those funds because they're mainly funded through donations, and funding it through the PUC would provide a more stable funding source so that this service could remain viable for this population.
Okay. Chairman Meyer, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm here today representing the commission, and for the record, I'm Lee Beyer, chairman of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. I'm also representing the Oregon Telecommunications Relay Service Industry Advisory Committee and the Oregon Telecommunications. I'm lost in that. Anyway. The two advisory committees that oversee the Residential Service Protection Fund program. For the record, the Residential Service Protection Program was created by the legislature to fund three services, and those essentially are services to the disabled, and it's intended to allow them to use telecommunication services, per se, and also low-income individuals. So that's what that program is all about. I guess our comments today is we think the Newsline program is a very good service, but our concern is it's not a telecommunications service per se, and so we have a concern about extending use of the RSPF surcharge on that basis to that. We're not talking a lot of money here. The program, as we understand it from the state librarian, is that it's about somewhere between $30,000 and $100,000 a year to run the program. So our concern is more about the methodology or where we're going here. And this goes more, it's sort of a camel nose under the tent argument. Over the past number of years, there have been a number of other programs for the disabled community that's been proposed to be funded through this methodology, through the same thing. And these have been from organizations such as the Arthritis Research Foundation, the Multiple Sclerosis Society, Muscular Dystrophy Society, Quadriplegia United Against Dependency and Transportation. That's just some of the ones. There have been a number of ones. All wonderfully good programs that have started, all having nothing to do with telecommunications. So that's really the issue. We think it's an inappropriate use of the fund to to do that. And I guess our concern long term is if we start, you know, if you start one, how do you say no to the next one that has a perfectly legitimate program? And pretty soon you've got the program maxed out at its 35 cents a level. And every time, it's about nine, a little over 9 cents now. Every time we change that, we hear from the customer base about being opposed to that. Why am I paying for this on my bill? Kind of a thing. So that's the nut of the concern that we have on this thing, Mr. Chairman, members.
Okay. I have a question, but I want to wait. We'll have Mr. Wolf speak, and then we'll have questions.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brant Wolf, representing the Oregon Telecommunications Association. You have my written comments in front of you, and basically we would echo exactly what Chairman Beyer has indicated. The industry believes that this program, as it currently exists, is it's well-run, it's well-administered, and efficiently administered, and we support it, and we have for many years here in front of this, here in the Capitol. We have opposed many efforts in the past to fund worthy programs with the fee, and that's what we're here to do today as well. This program that we're contemplating, it's a great program. We have absolutely no complaints with it or nothing to say about it that would be bad. It's just a funding mechanism. To kind of pick up where Chairman Beyer left off, or maybe mention something in addition to what he didn't, what he said. The statutory cap of 35 cents, as I understand, I serve on both the committees that Chairman Beyer mentioned in his testimony. And in sitting through those committees, we are learning and becoming aware of different technologies to help hearing impaired individuals connect to the telecommunications network. And those are going to cost some money to get in line and to help those folks. And as we have the fee increase this year from 5 cents to 9 cents, and as we understand it, it's probably going to increase again at some point in the future. So our fear also is that we would bump up against the cap and not be able to fund the programs, the actual telecommunications programs, if we open the door to funding other programs as well. And I guess that's really all I had to say. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Wolf. Ms. Fair, I just want to clarify. So
sure.
We have this program now. But what you're concerned about is the funding mechanism. Could you give me a little background as where that concern comes from?
Well, I think it's because the current funding sources are not quite as stable as the PUC source.
We are kind of captive under that source.
Yeah. So it's more about the stability of the source and the fear that the current funding mechanism, especially in the current economic climate, may become unviable in the near future.
Okay. Have you got any? I'm looking for some evidence of things where they're saying we're going to cut our funding this year or whatever for the program from the current sources that are listed. Do you have anything from them that has indicated that
I do not.
Place?
Some of the advocates that will be speaking shortly may have some evidence of that.
Okay. Thank you. Questions from the committee for these three folks? Okay. We may have some later.
Thank you.
Joyce Green, Linda Mock, and Alberto Enriquez. Enriquez. Please. And Ms. Green, we'll let you go first.
Okay. Come up a little closer. Keep there you go. Good afternoon, Senator Metzger and Chair and committee members. I thank you for this opportunity to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 849, and I feel very qualified to speak for it as a faithful daily listener since Newsline came to Oregon, and also as the person who coordinated bringing it to Oregon with the other two sponsors. Just by way of background, Newsline, as it currently exists, is a program whereby newspapers and journals are digitalized and transmitted computer to computer to a central computer bank, and then available via touch-tone telephone to all registered users. In 2003, because of a national grant, Oregon, as well as all other states, had the free use of the Newsline service, but at that time there were no Oregon papers on the service. But even at that time, I was a daily user. Then in 2006, the cost of Newsline was apportioned population-wise, state to state. So at that point, I felt that Newsline became a possibility for Oregon. I spoke with Jim Shepke and Susan Weston from the State Library and Linda Mock from the Commission. We put together a three-way sponsorship, the Library, the Commission, and the National Federation of the Blind of Oregon. But it's becoming very clear to us that Newsline cannot survive into the future on strictly donations, which has been the source of funding for all three of our organizations. I can speak only for the National Federation of the Blind of Oregon. On the money angle, we have spent about 12% of our total income to bring Newsline to blind Oregonians, because donations is the only source of our income. So, because I consider this such an essential thing to access information for blind people, I am strongly urging that this bill be passed. It's been a source of daily enrichment for me. I can get information on any topic, environmental issues, options for entertainment, legislation pending, medical and science advancements, and local news of every description. Because the telephone is essential for an audio news service, that's why I'm advocating for this bill, and because we cannot continue just on donations. I will say that for my last point, based on our 845 users in the month of February of 2009, and the estimated cost for the coming year of $32,381, the cost per user is only about $36 a year, and for that, the print disabled person gets access to 280 newspapers and journals. So, again, I urge passage of this bill, and I thank you very much for considering my remarks in your decision.
Thank you, Ms. Green, for your testimony, and you followed the written testimony very, very well. You had your facts and figures committed well. Thank you very much. That's very impressive.
Thank you.
Ms. Mock.
For the record, I'm Linda Mock, and I'm the administrator of the Oregon Commission for the Blind. And Chair Metzger and member of the committee, I would like to speak in support of the bill. The commission has voted to support Senate Bill 849. As you have probably heard, we have partnered over the past 3 years with the State Library and the NFB of Oregon to provide this service to blind Oregonians. And we feel that this is an excellent program offering a low-tech method for Oregonians who can't read print to get access to using the news, using the telephone. In addition, it allows them to download information to a computer or transfer it to a portable device so they can read the paper on the bus or in a coffee shop just like everyone else. It is also available to anyone who cannot read print, regardless of whether that is related to a vision loss. As Joyce described, users have access to over 280 publications, including the Oregonian, the Statesman Journal, and the Eugene Register Guard here, as well as a number of national newspapers such as USA Today, the AP of Oregon, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and the list obviously goes on and on. As Joyce pointed out, we currently have approximately 850 users per month that are using the service, and the cost is very reasonable. That's at a cost of $36 per person per year. And if you think about the cost of subscribing to just one newspaper, The Oregonian, it's about $168 a year. So it's a very reasonable price tag, I believe, for the service that's provided. Over the past 3 years, the Commission has been able to utilize donated funds that have come to our agency to make our contribution to the cost of the newsline. However, given the increasing demand on our donated funds, which, by the way, as a state agency, we do not solicit, and so we don't really have a way of replenishing them, we are being required to use our donated funds to match our basic vocational rehabilitation grant, which is our core service of our agency. So it's uncertain if we will have adequate funds to continue supporting this valuable program. We are aware that approximately 10 other states are using a similar surcharge to this to fund the program successfully. So there is a model out there with other states already using this avenue to provide ongoing sustainable support. Obviously, passage of this bill is a very small piece compared to the rest of the surcharge. We understand that it would be less than 0.2 cents per user. That would probably be enough to support the program. And it would reduce expenditures to both the State Library and the Commission for the Blind. This would be a sustainable long-term way to support a valuable service to individuals who are print disabled, and so we seek your support in passage of this bill. And thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. Jim Shetke, my colleague from the library, is here as well and is available if you had any questions that you wanted to ask either of us as the state agencies that have been supporting this program. Thank you.
Thank you. So just, I know you're just a contributor to it, but the indication is that in Ms. Green's testimony that the entire cost of the project based on the 845 rare users is a little over $32,000. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So, okay. Well, it's obviously a great service, and obviously, I mean, everything's money, and you have to find it somewhere, but this doesn't seem to be an insurmountable hurdle that somehow we need to find something to do that with. I'm impressed by the fact that it's $36 a year for 280 publications, and the Oregonian itself is 168. That's pretty...
That's a good deal.
Pretty remarkable. Yeah. I think I'm going to change my subscription. questions? Yes. Questions from the committee? Okay, thank you. Tina Hansen and
Mr. Enriquez.
Okay. I thought you were here to answer questions. I didn't have you on my sign-up list. I had Mr. Enriquez.
I signed up when it came in.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, my name is Alberto Enriquez.
Oh, you are never. Okay, I'm sorry.
And I am a grateful immigrant to this great country. Newspapers are a significant part of our nation's telecommunications. But newspapers are different. Community newspapers are uniquely designated newspapers of record. They carry public notices. As a sighted person, these notices are available to me. And over the years, I have attended literally thousands of public meetings. I feel strongly, as a naturalized American citizen, that what's available to me should be available to all. This is an equal protection issue under the law. And Senate Bill 849 provides for equal protection for all. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Enriquez. Any questions for Mr. Enriquez? Okay. Thank you, sir. Tina Hansen and Corrine Neville, if I said that right.
All right. All right.
Welcome.
Thank you.
You don't need to speak into it. Just sit back, relax. There you go. You're fine. Right there. We hear you. There you go.
Okay. Thank you very much. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. My name is Tina Hansen, and I live right here in Salem. I would like to speak in support of Senate Bill 849 because I am also a very grateful NFB Newsline user. I certainly enjoy using it not only on the phone, but also with a new initiative that is being sponsored by the National Federation of the Blind. I now have the ability to do it online in front of my PC, but I could also transfer the paper to a portable player and take it on the bus. So I'm very pleased that the NFB Newsline project is really entering the mobile market and giving its subscribers many other options so they can access the paper just about anywhere that their sighted peers. Like I said, if I'm on the bus or if I'm at the fitness center or whatever working out and want to see what's going on in the paper, I can do that. So I personally believe that this bill is going to be a boon because, as was said earlier, it will create the stability that's needed. And I just believe that this bill is going to be an asset, so I am asking for its passage. And sure, the economy is tough, but I think this is where we need information more than ever. So that I think a well-informed citizenry is really the best thing. Sure, the economy is bad, I won't deny it, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't care about what's going on so that we can formulate solutions. And that, in my book, is why NFB Newsline is such a valuable source. And that is why I'm speaking in favor of the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. Questions for Ms. Hansen? Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for your testimony.
I appreciate being able to speak before you. And I just wish good things for this.
Thank you very much. We do, too.
Thank you.
Kareem?
And by the way, please forgive. There's been a lot of cold in the air, so that's why I was having a little trouble up there, but I think everyone can forgive that.
We've all been there this year. hopefully only for once. Welcome. Welcome, Kareem.
Hi, my name is Corrine Vieville, and I'm the executive director of DUDE, Disabled United in Direct Empowerment in Southern Oregon, and also the president of the Jefferson chapter of the National Federation of the Blind of Oregon. And I helped Senator Bates' office draft the language for the bill, and 10 other states in the United States have already drafted and have in place bills that use the funding from their particular PUCs. They all have a little bit different name for them, but most of the programs also include the relay service and the adaptive equipment like ours does, the three programs. So, and then there's also several more states that are looking into getting this legislation, the same type of funding. So it's definitely a telecommunications issue. The program arrives at the end user through the telephone. And I submitted some written testimony that explains things in more detail. And basically, it's pretty much what everybody else has said. One thing I did want to bring up and emphasize is that we're not just one self-serving community. This isn't just for blind people, and it serves people with learning and reading disabilities. It serves people who are physically disabled and unable to hold a newspaper or turn a book or turn a page. It also recently, Tina mentioned the online version of the newspaper, that you can go to a secure website and download the paper or read it online, and that enables, for the first time, deaf-blind people to be able to access the newspaper that way through the Internet, since they aren't going to be able to use the telephone, that's obvious. But deaf-blind people use Braille for their means of reading, and so this allows them to access the paper through their PC with a Braille display and either read it online, at the computer, or download it to a portable Braille note taker, something like this, and that can be taken with you. So I put the newspaper in here and take it with me and read it in Braille at my leisure, downloading it off the Internet. So now we have several options for being able to access this, and it includes more populations. So we're pretty, cover a lot of disabilities in this, and so it's not just another, you know, bright program of good things. It really does cover more. And I think everybody else has covered everything pretty much. There's also a second channel available that allows state agencies and organizations to, instead of choosing a newspaper when you dial up the phone, you dial in, you have a passcode, the system recognizes you and says, welcome, Ms. Vieville, and then you choose a state, you choose a paper, you choose a section of the paper, you choose an article, and then you start reading, and you can read. You can go back, you can skip by paragraph, you can skip to another article, you can read word by word, you can have it spell you names of things. So we, and that's a big problem when there's a lot of auditory information. Spelling is kind of our downfall sometimes. But that system enables you to actually check the spelling of particular words or names as you're reading. And forgot where I was going with that. Oh, so instead of choosing a newspaper, you can log in and choose the second channel, the Oregon second channel. And on that second channel, different agencies and organizations can put announcements up so that they're conforming to the 508 regulations of making their information accessible by putting it up on Newsline. The commission has a spot. The library has a spot. The different organizations for the blind have a section, and they put up little articles or information.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Neva. I know you had given us an opportunity, maybe if you wanted to talk to somebody in Texas, but I think we've kind of got the gist of this, because I think people are supportive of the program. I'm going to ask for questions for you, and then I'm going to bring Mr. Beyer back up, because I've generated a couple questions on that.
I did have one more thing to say.
Yes.
And I think that Linda Mock did mention the cost. I haven't ever been able to get, I've asked for several months for a budget of the revenue that the fund, the RSPF fund, generates, to get an idea of where our program would fit in and how much of, you know, what where it would fit. And I haven't been able to get that information. I keep getting promised, and I never get it. So it's been very frustrating. And I did an estimate kind of from some figures that I found, and I've come up with it being about 0.2 cents to run our program of what the revenue's already been generating, of the generated revenue.
Well, we're interested in it, too, and we will find out what that is. Okay? I assure you of that.
Thank you.
Any questions? Okay, thank you. Chairman Beyer, would you come back up for kind of conclude us for today, because I want to, and now that we've kind of had a good feeler for this, I did have a couple of questions. I guess the first one is, Mr. Chairman, is that the cost of this program, as we look at cost for a lot of things, it's extremely small. So when I mean, we'll find out exactly, you know, what the collection is on, but this would seem to be, I think it would pencil out a very small part. But the second thing about it is your comment about, and Mr. Wolf made the comment also, you know, concerns that it might not be appropriate for the Residential Service Protection Fund. And I want to just probe that a little bit more, because it is using a telecommunications device, which is what we, you know, we provide these things. This is receiving from the telephone. And I just was wondering, you know, how certain you are of that this is not appropriate for consideration as a means? So, you know, I got the two questions, the cost, what this really would do as a percentage, because it would seem pretty small. But then number two is people to communicate with the outside world through the telephone, and we provide these services through this fund. They're also doing the same thing. It's the content's different, you know, the content of speech, whether you're talking to somebody or accessing, you know, other types of services, but it would seem to be the same mechanism. So I just wanted to revisit that issue with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, there's certainly no question that you'd be using a telephonic instrument. And that's the core of the program. There's lots of other things out there, programs that you can go through and use a telephone as an instrument to get there. I mean, so there's nothing different there. I think the way that the legislature created the RSPF program was the intent of allowing all Oregonians, regardless of their income level or their disability, to enjoy relatively the same use of the telephone for what we consider traditional communications purposes with that, and that's essentially talking with other people. And that's the purpose of the program. That's what it was for. So it really gets to your judgment. I mean, the legislature created RSPF, and it's back to you. Do you see this as one of those services? We're at this point with the disabled side, we have relay services in terms of where you as an able hearing person would be able to call a relay, and that comes back in a sign, a visual, so we have those kinds of things. We're now looking with people with other disabilities having more complex equipment, so you know, there's an array of things out there, but I'm bibbling here a little bit, but I think it falls back in the terms of it's really your decision of how far, you know, what's telecommunications and how far do you want to go into that. And again, I think our comment, and I think what the industry comment is starting that creep. We have over the years had requests for more things there. The money issues, you know, it's not that big. What if you look at the bill itself, what you're doing is directing the PUC to establish and maintain a program. So if you did that, we would go through a rulemaking and we would establish a program if that's what you want us to do. And I can't tell you how much it would cost. All I can tell you is in my staff talking with the state librarian, they said that as they operate the program, it's somewhere between $30,000 and $100,000 a year based on today's stuff. So that's all we know about the cost of the program. And if you told us we had to go forth and set up a program, we'd go forth and set up a program. That's what we do. We follow what you tell us to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you stay there? Mr. Willis, I know we had some email communication. I think you'd have some data with you that might answer some of the questions that were brought up. And then we'll see before we conclude this hearing if there's any other questions. Regarding the current telephone surcharge accounts, the income, what's funded, and the expenditures, could you give us a little light on, just so we understand what this is generating and what it does?
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Rick Willis. The RSPF program generates about $5 million a year, $10 million a biennium. In terms of cost for this program, again, not knowing for sure how much it costs, it's somewhat less than a penny on the surcharge. Mm-hmm. And if that's what your question was, it's a very small amount.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That would be a penny for each telephone customer.
Correct.
Well, each telephone customer that falls under our regulation.
Per month.
Some do not.
It's
right.
Per customer per month.
And the current, we're up to...
We're at 9 cents.
Nine cents right now for to generate the $5 million.
Correct.
And just for the committee's benefit and the audience who has testified, just very briefly summarize the services that are provided with that 9 cents currently.
Okay. Mr. Chair, there are essentially three services that come under RSPF. One is the relay service, and that is where a hearing impaired person communicates with a hearing person. It goes through a relay person, a communications specialist, who listens to the hearing person, types that out to the non-hearing person, receives that back, talks it to the hearing person. So there's that. The second piece is a loan program, and that's a program where we loan the instruments for the relay. They can be the old TTYs, if folks remember those. They can be phone amplifiers. They can be speech-generating machines. There's a number of different pieces of equipment that we loan to hearing-impaired, speech-impaired, mobility-impaired individuals so that they can communicate through the telephone. The third leg of the stool for RSPF is the low-income piece, and that is the program provides a subsidy to low-income citizens, and they have to qualify for being 135% of federal poverty level. And we provide, along with the federal government, a subsidy for their basic phone service. No bells and whistles, no long distance, just basic phone service. The feds kick in $10 a month. We kick in $3.50 a month. So they get a $13.50 subsidy on their phone service. There's other little pieces, yeah, like the Lifeline, which helps them set up the initial phone service. Again, not pay for the whole thing, but assist in setting up the initial phone service.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Wells. Questions for the Public Utility Commission? Okay, Chairman Beyer, I'm going to ask if you would put your excellent thinking cap on, and after you've heard the testimony too, we all agree this is a great program, and see if we might generate some thoughts about how we can provide some more stability to something that we, you know, think is very, very valuable. So we'll do that. Okay.
Okay. You have someone else who wants.
Thank you, sir. Is there somebody else that would wish to testify before we move on to the next bill for the day?
Yeah,
yes, sir. Come on forward. And then we're going to be moving on to our next item. So, by the way, out in the audience there, Ms. Neville, I hope that helped you get the information that you heard them talk about the cost of the program. And
thank you. That's kind of what I asked.
It's pretty fast service, pretty fast turnaround, huh? Yes, sir. Welcome.
Yeah, hi. My name is Bill Hahey, and I'm from Southern Oregon. And I had a question, and also I'd like to say that the Newsline has been a great thing for me because I've been transplanted from Pennsylvania to Oregon, and now I can go back and read the papers from Philadelphia and see what's happening in my hometown and see what's happening, you know, where I used to live. But also, my question is, if I can have an operator or a voice-activated person or entity saying, the number you have reached is 541-000 so-and-so-and-so, why can't I have a newspaper saying the top story today is so-and-so and such-and-so on my phone? If I could, I don't even get the courtesy of a personal operator, but they don't want to give me the phone service of the Newsline, pay for that. Mm-hmm. I think that they should just do it.
Yeah. Mr. Hagee, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right.
Okay. All right. We're going to work on this, okay? We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 849. And committee, as you've noticed, we're a three-man committee today. I think before we go to the next public hearing, since all three of us are here and I need all three of us, I'm going to open the work session on Senate Bill 579. This was the bill that we heard earlier, but we did not have the fiscal on it, the restraints in Class 1 or Class 2 vehicles, which are available to be used on the highways that come equipped with restraints, must be worn by children. Jen, both of you want to come forward in case the committee has any questions. We're looking at the Dash 5 amendment. There's the one here for this that we got our fiscal. We've testified on the bill, but just you might review it just real briefly, what that does. Again, this is the companion to the helmet bill, but we weren't able to move it the other day.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to mention that we do have fiscal statements. This is what we've been waiting on, is
right,
the fiscal statements, and we have minimal fiscal statements on both of the amendments.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Metzger, committee members. I'm Randy Nicolay from the Oregon Recreation Coalition. I've been working on these bills with Jen and we've definitely been doing our legwork on trying to get through some of these amendment applications. Ironically, just this last week, Yamaha, in their wisdom working with the Consumer Product Safety Council, came out with a voluntary recall, and this slip that's being passed to you now is basically the new placard that will go on their vehicles. And notice the first thing right off the bat is fasten your belt or have your recommendation of wearing your seat belt. So Amendment 5 covers this pretty thoroughly for us right now, but there's also a lot of loopholes in Class 2 type vehicles, and even that much more reason why we, in talking last week, need the task force to help segregate out some of these other vehicles and trying to get as much safety coverage as we can for our under 16-year-olds.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Senator Starr.
I move the dash 5 minutes to Senate Bill 579.
Senator Starr has moved the dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 579. Any objections?
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved 579 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Devlin will carry this as well. Thank you again, and give our best to Lindy for her hard work.
She's definitely being poked by the doctor today again. So.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
You got to push the best for her.
Thank you very much. All right, we're closing that work session. Now we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 600.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 600 makes credit union depositories subject to the same provisions currently governing bank depositories for public funds placed on deposit. It specifies procedures for public officials to take when a loss occurs in a credit union depository, and it declares an emergency takes effect upon a passage of a dash one amendment, which delays the operative date to January 1st, 2011, also allows private contributions to state treasurer for the purpose of paying for the initial expenses of the measure.
Thank you. Bring the proponents forward, Pam Levitt, Hal Scoggins, and Ron Barrett. No, in the treasurer's office, but but he can wait a little bit. He can wait a little bit.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 600, which is a bill introduced by the state treasurer. We thought they would go first to talk about their bill, but we will certainly be here to support their bill. Background on public deposits, Mr. Chair, I have testimony packets that I can bring up. Can I go grab them?
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you.
But I know you won't read them anyway.
I will not, I promise. Public deposits are come from local government agencies, entities, deposited into financial institutions by the treasurer or a state or local government unit. And I gave you some examples in the testimony of public deposits, public utility districts, cemetery districts, ports, cities and counties, fire districts, school districts, as some examples. In the 2003 session, we passed a bill that would allow credit unions to accept public deposits up to the federal insured limit, and at that time it was $100,000. In the recent months, that the federal deposit insurance limit per account has risen to $250,000. So currently, that is the limit for credit unions for public deposits. We think there are several reasons why this bill is important to Oregon communities. We think that increasing the ability for credit unions to accept public deposits will produce better competition for our very valuable state dollars. Federally insured credit unions would provide an additional option in the marketplace for these deposits. And we certainly believe it's an issue of choice in being able to choose which financial institution you'd like to do business with. Second, we believe it would benefit local communities because credit union deposits reside in locally owned cooperatives that are headquartered and make loans in which in the communities in which they operate. There are four 4,000, at least 4,000 public agencies in Oregon that receive public deposits and require the services of financial institutions. And we think that having the ability to have them choose a credit union is an excellent option for the public money. There are several limitations that are built into our regulatory structure, and I listed had some examples of those. I'm going to have our attorney, Hal Scoggins, kind of go over the technical aspects of Senate Bill 600.
Okay, Ms. Scoggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Hal Scoggins. I'm with Farley Wada Witt. We're the attorneys for the Credit Union Association of Oregon and many of the credit unions in Oregon. And from a technical perspective, this bill is actually pretty simple. As Ms. Leavitt mentioned, credit unions have for several years been able to accept public funds deposits up to the federally insured amount, which right now sits at $250,000. That has been temporary until December 31st of this year. It's likely that Congress is going to make it permanent for both banks and credit unions. For banks accepting public funds beyond the federally insured amount, banks have to collateralize those public funds, and there's a collateral pool that's established in which banks participate. And what this bill does simply is to create a collateral pool for credit unions, and credit unions would participate in exactly the same way that banks currently do. Well-capitalized credit unions would be required to collateralize their public funds at a specific level, and the state treasurer's office could determine to increase that level based on input from the Department of Consumer and Business Services. At the outset, it is likely, while the program gets up and running and before there are large numbers of credit unions participating, it's likely that the treasurer will set the collateral limit at least 100% or 110% in order to ensure that the risk is appropriately dealt with and not just concentrated in a few institutions. Over time, it's likely that the treasurer would decrease that limit, but that's the bill is going to leave that up to the discretion of the treasurer based on the treasurer's review of the financial circumstances of each institution involved and on input from the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The same limits that would currently apply to banks would also apply to credit unions. No institution can have more than 200% of its net worth in public funds deposits, and really that's simply all that this bill does. Is it says we'll set up a collateral pool for credit unions. Credit unions that choose to participate can. They put up collateral to secure the public funds deposits, and away they go. The program is self-funding. Those who choose to participate are those who will actually pay for the employees and infrastructure in the treasurer's office to oversee the program. And that's it. That's a very simple and straightforward bill.
Thank you. I'll go to Mr. Barrick, and then we'll open to questions. And it's good to see you again, Ron.
You too, Rick. Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Ron Barrick, President and CEO of Advanced Credit Union. We're headquartered in Milwaukee, Oregon, and currently serve over 39,000 members, primarily in the Portland metropolitan area. I'm here today to request your support of Senate Bill 600, the Oregon State Treasurer's Department initiative to provide more deposit options for public entities throughout the state. The bill is simple and straightforward. It will allow public entities to deposit funds in Oregon credit unions over the current $250,000 insured limit. The Oregon legislature passed a bill in 2003 that allowed public entities to make deposits in credit unions but capped the amount at the then insured limit of $100,000. However, this limit is so restrictive as to effectively eliminate credit unions as a depository option for even the smallest public entities. We believe this is a free market issue, and as I'm sure you know, credit unions are locally owned by their members and controlled by volunteer boards of directors from the membership. We think that local public entities should have the option of using the services of their locally owned credit unions. Credit unions throughout Oregon regularly receive service requests from public officials in their communities. Among the groups that have approached Oregon credit unions are local public utility districts, rural fire districts, city fire and police departments, school districts, and city and county governments. Reasons that we often hear they would like to work with us include credit unions are locally owned and operated financial institutions, and in fact, in certain parts of the state, they're the only such institution in their service area. They personally know members of our volunteer board of directors and audit committee, and they know their deposits will be used to provide loans to members of their local community. The longstanding commitment of credit unions to community service and involvement because it's the right thing to do, not because of federal mandates. Credit unions have a long history of providing free services to nonprofit organizations. Credit unions work with local school systems and senior centers in providing financial education. And employees of these organizations know and trust us. We also believe passage of this legislation is good public policy because it fulfills the requests of numerous public entities for more options with whom to do business. Additional options create more competition for public deposits. The additional competition will naturally lead to better rates of return on the deposits, regardless of whether the public entity actually elects to do business or change their account relationship with credit unions. It reduces the exposure to the state treasurer's office by spreading the risk of public funds deposits over a greater number of financial institutions. And it's not breaking any new ground. This is a proven model. It's already in place and working very well in 19 other states. So in summary, public entities would like the option of being able to place deposits with their locally owned and controlled credit unions. However, the existing $100,000 cap on the amount that public entities may deposit in credit unions is simply too low to allow for efficient investment management options, thus eliminating credit unions as a viable alternative. It makes sense for credit unions to be allowed to meet the service requests of the public entities within their field of membership, and it's good public policy to do so. For these reasons, we respectfully request that you support the State Treasurer's Initiative and adopt this common-sense proposal to remove the existing cap. Local public entities throughout the state will benefit and would appreciate your support of Senate Bill 600. Thank you for your time and the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett. Questions from the committee? Okay, thank you. Now we'll ask the State Treasurer's Office to come forward, Mike Salvaggio. Colleagues, this bill was originally drafted on behalf of Senator Ben Westland, and he decided to seek other employment. So I was pleased to have his request to introduce this on behalf of him, and I kind of wanted the order here to Mr. Salvaggio so that the references to the treasurer, we would then have the treasurer be able to put in context the proponent's messages and to keep us in order on that. So welcome.
Thank you very much. Chair Metzger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. I am afraid that the bulk of my testimony has already been explained, but I wanted to address a few things, specifically that this is optional for local governments. This is another tool in their toolbox in how they change to how they choose to manage their finances, not at all mandatory. And especially there are three things that I want to put on record for the committee. The first, dealing with the amendments, you have the -1 amendments that set back the implementation date and allow for startup funds to be assembled from private sources. However, we do plan on having additional amendments come which address the scenario in which those funds, for whatever reason, don't show up, and they would allow the treasurer to delay implementation if the funds weren't available, so we didn't get into a situation in which we were mandated to establish a program with no funds. The second thing I want to note is, as Mr. Scoggins mentioned previously, at first the treasurer would likely impose a 100% or more collateralization rate. A pool of funds doesn't make much sense if you only have one player in there and somebody's got to be first in the pool, and as was referenced, that presumably that number would come down over time, but initially it would be set at 100% or more. The last thing I want to note is that Senate Bill 62 is making its way through the Senate right now, which will be making technical changes to the way that the bank pool is administered, and we will eventually want to amend Senate Bill 600 to conform to those changes as well. So in light of that information and the information already presented by the Credit Union Association, I will take questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Salvaggio. Any questions for the Treasurer's Office? Thank you.
Thank you.
Linda Navarro and Tim Martinez, please. Welcome, Linda. Good to see you again.
Thank you.
I see him all the time, so it's always good to see Mr. Martinez, but
Thank you,
welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. I just was sitting back there with a sense of deja vu all over again, as Yogi Berra once said, I think. I very much remember the 2003 session and the legislation that allowed for the insured limit. While we were opposed to that on the general philosophy of it, it clearly passed. As the bill did work its way through the process, there was testimony, I believe, on both sides that seemed to indicate that you know, they were being primarily asked by smaller government entities to be available, and that there wasn't a real desire for this to be a unlimited program. I would also point out that, you know, it was 100,000 when it was passed in 2003. It's now 150% of that. It's 250,000. So there has been an increase because of what's happened at the federal level in the last 5 or 6 years. So they have a huge increase as far as a percentage since this bill was passed. A couple other comments before I turn it over to Linda Navarro, the President and CEO of the Oregon Bankers Association. The public funds program that we have now for banks was a process of probably 6, 8, maybe even 10 years. In fact, I'm sorry that the Deputy State Treasurer isn't here today, Darren Bond, because he's been part of that program. I've worked with him on that over at least the last 10 years, trying to get it organized and get it right. The association spent basically the whole 05 interim working with the state treasurer and local governments to develop this pool to make it work for banks. And we, as the state treasurer's staff said, we are tweaking it even today to make it better. But we have a difficult time seeing how you would just literally drop in wherever it talks about banks, credit unions, and saying, okay, this is now a pool for credit unions and it'll work the same. You know, the real fundamental difference, of course, is, you know, a bank is a profit entity, and we don't apologize for that. You know, many of us probably have stock in banks. If there is an issue where you need to raise more capital, it's more easily accomplished than it would be for a credit union. A credit union, as a cooperative and as owned by its membership, would either have to go out and get a bunch of new members to help increase the capital or look at their returned earnings. But it's not something that can be done quick and easy as far as putting out a capital call as a bank could do. So I would just leave you with one final thought before I turn it over to Linda. Credit unions have not been immune to the problems that the whole financial industry is facing. Clearly, in Oregon, we've had two banks fail this year. That is a sad thing, not only for the folks that work there, but for their depositors. But the depositors, in both of those instances, because of the deposit insurance, were not harmed. The banks that took over those institutions also agreed to cover all the deposits, so not a single person was harmed. As you very well know, Mr. Chairman, the stockholders can't always say that when it comes
That's
to
true.
Financial institutions. But as I said, there are some issues within the credit union system as well, and probably the biggest one deals with what's known as corporate credit unions. Just last month in the biggest one out west, called Western Corporate, was placed into conservatorship. As a result of that, and we clearly don't have any final numbers or what's how it all will turn out, but as a result of that, it's very likely that many credit unions in Oregon are going to have to increase their assessments to help cover those losses. Right now, as I understand it, the NCUA is saying it could be a 5.4 at a minimum. It could be as high as $16 billion, and somewhere between 5.4 and that number is where they ultimately see it shaking out. So the credit unions in Oregon and other places are indeed going to have to pay more fees for that. I bring that up because, you know, there is always, it seems to us anyway, a danger of just saying, okay, we can do this just like the banks. And that appears to be what we're saying here. The banks are doing it, we can do it. My last comment, and I promise this is my last one, is the gentleman that testified before talks about this is not breaking any new ground. It's already in place in 19 other states. What I believe he was referring to is that public fund deposits are allowed in 19 other states. We're not aware of any other state that has gone down this road for credit unions and setting up a collateral pool. I'm not aware of any state. So with that, I would turn it over. Happy to answer any questions or turn it over to
we'll let Ms. Norrell speak, and then we'll see if there's some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Linda Navarro, President and CEO of the Oregon Bankers Association, and we represent the 60 traditional banks and trust companies that do business in the state of Oregon. And I'll just start by saying, because banks are in the news quite a bit these days, when I talk about traditional banking, I'm talking about highly regulated depository institutions that have a responsibility for safekeeping of their customers' funds, and that includes public entities. That's a very important long-standing relationship between banks and their local governments, and it's of paramount importance because the banks in turn lend these funds back out in their communities, particularly to small businesses, which is the focus of the banking services of most community banks in this state. I'd like to make just three quick points, and I'll try not to repeat what's already been said as to why we're in opposition to Senate Bill 600. The first really relates to the issue of fairness and public policy. The second, about the complexity of the public deposit protection program. And then just a quick closing word about deposit insurance. As you know, until 2003, credit unions had no public fund depository authority in Oregon, and we didn't agree with the move to go to 100, but ultimately that the $100,000 insurance limit, but ultimately that's what happened. But a lot of states haven't gone down that road at all. The majority of states have not gone down that road. And why? Because credit unions' tax-exempt status was given to them to serve people of limited means. You can go back to the founding of the credit union charter. But today's credit unions, many of them, certainly not all of them, have grown and become what we consider bank-like. And bank-like in the services that they provide or want to provide to their communities. And yet the key difference is that they remain tax-exempt. So the reason we opposed it in 2003 and why we continue to oppose it, there is a fundamental issue, a public policy issue here, which is unless and until credit unions that want to be like a bank are taxed and regulated like a bank, they shouldn't be granted every service that a tax-paying financial institution is granted. Our banks that are in some cases 10, 20 times smaller than a credit union competing in their market pay taxes on their first dollar of profits. But they're competing against credit unions. The largest credit union headquartered in this state, I believe, is second only to Umpqua Bank in its size. And it competes against financial institutions, as I said, that are 10 or 20 times smaller. So there's an equity issue, and those deposits are so key right now to banks and any financial institution that's trying to compete in this marketplace. Those local deposits are essential, and to be able to compete for public dollars when you don't pay state income tax to us is a matter of equity and fairness. But if you're not completely swayed by that argument, a couple of other points. I've been involved in public funds. Tim mentioned we've been involved with it for 10 years. This has been a program and a policy issue I've been intimately involved with. And I won't go into the complexities of the current program, but suffice to say, it is extremely complex. We're still tweaking a brand new program that you only adopted last year after, as Tim said, a two-year work group process that included many local governments, the treasurer's office, and many banks and bank council over well over a dozen work group meetings and literally hundreds of hours of time. We came up with a program customized for Oregon banks. It's unlike any other program in the nation. There's some similarities to Washington, but it's completely customized based on the way banks are regulated and the way banks serve their customers. We're, as Tim said, tweaking it today, but I think it's very premature to automatically assume that it's a one-size-fits-all program, and what works for this type of financial institution charter would automatically work for another kind of financial institution charter. So happy to answer specific questions about that, but as I said, it's very complex, with the core principle being protecting public depositors through a pooled collateral, which creates significant risk for other financial institutions that play in that pool. You're agreeing to assume the liability in the event of a failure of uninsured public funds that occur because of another institution in the pool. And then lastly, I'll just close again by saying $250,000 is, as our friends from the Credit Union Association said, likely to be made permanent for banks and for credit unions as the future minimum deposit insurance. That represents, as Tim said, a 150% increase over what credit unions got for the first time in Oregon in 2003, which is more than what they have in other states. And we think that represents, at this time and in this climate, a significant enough increase in their ability to serve those small municipalities and local governments that they've indicated in testimony are part of what they are trying to accomplish with this bill. So with that, I'll close and offer to answer any questions, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Navarro. Questions for either of our guests? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Work on this a little bit. Colleagues, what is today, Wednesday? Well, first of all, let me close with public hearing at Senate Bill 600. Tomorrow, for our committee, Mr. Stembridge.
Tomorrow is a transportation day. We'll be talking about utility relocation and a couple of bills about documents issued by the Department of Transportation.
Okay.
Minor little bills.
Yeah.
Minor little bills. Okay. We are adjourned.